No question. There's plenty of bad news when it comes to the environment. Now get ready for some good.
I don't have a lot of patience for people that the first words out of their mouth is that that'll be difficult, or we can't do that, or I'm not willing to do that.
Your fish are dying from too much waste in the water? Here's an idea.
We removed 50% of the nitrogen in the wastewater, which is minor retrofits.
Are you worried about global warming from too much CO2?
There is potential for us to build sidewalks where, yes, these sidewalks will suck CO2 out of the air.
Scientists and engineers are working right now on some of the tools we hope will lift us out of our environmental malaise.
The issue is, can you do those things that we already know how to do with new materials and new ways to do it so it's really cheap, cheap, cheap?
We explore sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering, coming up after this hour's news. This is Sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave. If you're paying any attention at all, how can you not know? This planet has some huge problems.
Try not to take a deep breath. If you breathe the air for too long in the village of Gurjo Tau, it may make you ill, and it may even end up killing you.
Fish stocks in the Pacific are said to be dropping. Many reasons for this, everything from overfishing to pollution to global warming.
As the sea ice is melting, polar bear habitat is just plain disappearing.
The population of Lagos has grown from 300,000 in 1950 to over 14 million today.
The country is now home to some of the most polluted cities and waterways on the planet.
Fouled air, fetid water, global warming. Things are worse than they've ever been, right? Actually, there are people who'll say, wrong.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution.
Baby boomers, and anyone else alive in the 50s and 60s, can remember when you could taste the air in Los Angeles. When American lakes were as horrible as anything we read about today in China. And when people driving down the highway would just throw their trash out the window.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare.
And our attention riveted to the environment? That's not new either. 40 years ago, there were congressional hearings on the environment. There were presidential speeches.
The water we drink, the food we eat, the very air that we breathe are threatened with pollution.
It was in Broadway musicals.
Welcome, sulfur dioxide. Hello. Carbon monoxide, the air is everywhere.
It was in the movies.
Now, when I was a kid, food was food. For our scientific magicians, poisoned the water, polluted the soil, decimated plant and animal life. Why, in my day,
that's Edward G. Robinson in Soylent Green from 1973. Of course, the principal environmental evil was different back then. So was the solution. In the 70s, they told us the problem was overpopulation. In Soylent Green, Charlton Heston uncovers what the government decided to do about it.
It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them Soylent Green is people!
Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale.
So environmental problems are not new. But that doesn't mean today's not different. And plenty of people will tell you, it certainly doesn't mean it's not worse.
These are not your parents' environmental problems. It's no longer just about the landfill crisis, or smoggy urban air, or the extinction of cute, cuddly critters.
Joel McCower is executive editor of GreenBiz.com and a commentator on Marketplace. He's reading here from his book, Strategies for the Green Economy.
Today's environmental challenges are far beyond anything we faced before, affecting not just the birds and the trees, but also, potentially, the economics, public health, and well-being of all humans, too.
People like Joel McCower will tell you that today's environmental problems are nothing like what we faced in the 60s.
Cleveland, even now I can remember, 'cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams.
Think, for example, about the burning Cuyahoga River of June 1969, on one hand, and on the other, think about an inconvenient truth. The burning river in 1969 typifies problems that were local, single cause, things that you could see or smell. Fairly easy to resolve. If you stop the cause, the problem would go away. Today, if you think about global climate change as typical of the current kinds of problems, it's global. It's from multiple causes, so from thousands of different actions and activities. And we're not really sure we can solve it.
Burn on, big river, burn on.
And a lot of other smart people see our problems today and think they're on a whole different scale from the way things were in the era of don't be a litter bug. Michael Prather is a professor at UC Irvine and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Prize along with Al Gore.
Some people view it as more imminently serious than others. Others of us view it as a long-term problem, but all of us take it as a serious problem. If we don't do anything about it, the world will be a very unpleasant place for our children's children to live in.
He's talking there about scientists. But what about the rest of us? Do we get it? Here's Larry Nyes, Purdue University's civil engineering professor.
I don't think the vast majority of the public grasps the seriousness of the energy and the water challenges that are facing us in the future.
Want an example? How about Bob Lutz, vice chairman of General Motors, who, as Leslie Stahl reported on 60 Minutes, recently said,
man-made global warming is a crock of sh-.
The public, I think, is now catching on that this is an issue.
Now shows that 72% of American citizens are completely or mostly convinced that global warming is happening.
I'm not sure that the average person understands the severity or what it means to them. Climate change is like a tsunami you can see coming from a long ways away. We don't know whether it's going to be 2 feet high or 20 feet high.
He says scientists can't quantify that severity, so people don't know whether or not to be concerned. And, he says,
the big danger, the loss of ecosystems, the change in the water supply on a large scale, is going to happen in 10, 20, 30 years or more. And I think it's hard to get people excited unless you can be more specific.
Even those of us who do get it underestimate how big a problem it is and think it's going to be easy to solve.
Now I am throwing off the carelessness of youth to listen to an inconvenient truth that I need to move.
This is the credit sequence from Al Gore's movie, where along with being told who the producer and the director are, we're also told the climate crisis can be solved, and we're given instructions on how to do it. Things like buy energy-efficient light bulbs, recycle, buy a hybrid car, call radio shows and write newspapers. As Joel McCower of GreenBiz.com says,
we've been told that there's a lot of simple things that we can do, and that if we all swap out our light bulb, if we all buy the right car or maybe switch cleaning products, that we'll somehow be able to shop our way to environmental health. And of course, that's not the case.
No, it's not going to be easy. Purdue University's Larry Nyes says, far from it.
I think we face very difficult times ahead of us. We're going to have very, very serious energy problems that are going to cause great economic hardship. It's going to cause an entire transformation of our society, I really believe. And we have very serious water issues facing us as well. I think we would be doing a disservice to the public if we gave anybody the idea that the problems we need to solve are going to be easy.
Okay, we're not telling you all this to depress you. Really, believe me, we're not. Because, as Joel McCower says, when you do that, just piling on environmental problem after environmental problem, people just shut down.
Most people get paralyzed, and that's not a place we want to be either.
Purdue's Larry Nyes says there's a better solution.
We need to stop using fear. I think we need to start using encouragement and challenge them to see the future as a great thing and challenge them to see the opportunities and how we can improve the lives of our children and our grandchildren.
So this is not to depress you. It's to get you charged up. But with a problem this big, we have to figure that you're asking,
how can I possibly help?
We want to show you that you can. Here's what some people are doing on a large scale and what you can do yourself.
Meg, what? It's 7:05. We've got to go. You have to brush your teeth and get your backpack.
Okay.
Come on, honey.
Letty's a working mom with two kids. She lives outside Washington, D.C.
All right, let me tell Dad that we're leaving.
Tim, we're out of here.
We thought we'd try an experiment. We had Letty go through her normal day while we looked over her shoulder. Obviously, Letty's a very good sport. And as if that wasn't enough, we asked Michael Prather of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to critique her choices. No, it's not fair. It's not even nice. But it's for the good of science.
And this light is the longest light in Silver Spring. That's how I feel.
According to the World Resources Institute, people in countries like ours put out 6 times the amount of CO2 as people in the third world. And right now, Americans account for close to 25% of all CO2 emissions.
The transportation sector, which includes people driving to work every day, is probably about 25% of the global warming gases.
Michael Prather.
Sitting still and running your engine is probably the least efficient use. You're going nowhere and you're putting out CO2. One of the key efficiencies people note is to have the freeways and the street systems designed in a way that minimize the waste of fuel.
My office is kind of on the smaller side, very cozy and compact. Fluorescent lights in the ceiling.
One of our major power sectors that we all need and live with is electricity. Most of our power in the U.S. is coal.
Burning coal is a major greenhouse gas producer, even what they call clean coal. The clean part has nothing to do with CO2 emissions.
So we're going to go down to B1, the basement level of the building, and I'm going to get a Diet Coke out of the machine down there.
Our electrical power use is obvious. We know when we turn a switch. But we do keep many things on that we don't need to. So there is a lot of electricity use on the edge that we don't think about.
We make choices every day. And so many of them can influence the size of our environmental footprint. But the nice thing about choice is you can take one route or another. And when it comes to your impact on the planet, that can present opportunities. Now, let's be realistic here. You don't design your own highways. You don't lay out your own electrical grid. But Michael Prather says there are things an individual can do to have an environmental impact on a large scale.
There's going to be no person who comes in on a white horse to solve the problem, and every little bit counts.
So here's a look at some things that an individual can do.
We're looking between two of the houses. They're probably about 50 feet apart, and we're looking at the foothills of the Alleghenies.
Lenny Mazza is standing at the edge of a housing development called Hunter Fall Farms. He and his wife moved here about a year ago. The houses sit in the middle of a Christmas tree farm in Ortana, Pennsylvania, about 8 miles from Gettysburg. This looks like your typical new cul-de-sac development, but it's no ordinary community. And a look up at any of the houses here will tell you why.
You can see solar panels on all the roofs. You can also see a bank of windows that are facing due south, and these windows are designed to soak up solar energy.
Hunter Fall Farms is designed to be a 100% environmentally sustainable community.
Well, we're walking up to my house. We're coming up to my porch right now.
The people at Hunter Fall Farms have taken a radical step. They've made an investment that allows them to live lives that leave a footprint remarkably smaller than most Americans.
So when the sun comes in the winter, it actually heats up this tile under our feet. So you've got tile and you also have cement backer board underneath it and it acts as a heat sink.
That helps heat the houses in the winter. And for summer, every house has an overhang which keeps the sun from making it too hot inside. Plus, on every house, 3/4 of the first floor is surrounded by dirt.
So you have the natural heating and cooling aspects of the earth working to your advantage.
The houses at Hunter Fall Farms are on the electric grid, but they only use it for emergencies. Lenny's solar panels generate twice as much power as he needs, and he doesn't need the grid to heat his water. Lenny uses 300 kilowatt hours of electricity a month in this house. In his old house, it was around 1,600. Lenny walks next door to talk with one of the founders of the community.
Bill Hartson.
Bill and Lenny walk up a slight hill from the houses, so Bill can show off the most astounding thing about this already remarkable community. Remember, this is a sustainable community, so energy is not the only thing they're saving. In Hunter Fall Farms, they flush their toilets knowing full well that what goes around comes around. And believe it or not, they actually like it. We'll explain that when we come back. Plus, what if you could stop global warming by just sucking the CO2 right out of the air? We look at ways to do it. That's when we come back. This is Sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave, and we'll be back after a break. This is Sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave. We're in rural Pennsylvania, close to Gettysburg, and we're paying a visit to Hunter Fall Farms, an environmentally sustainable suburb set in the middle of an old Christmas tree farm. We're with Bill Hertzel, one of the founders of the community. As we've heard, the houses here are designed to slash electricity use, but it's here at the top of this hill. What they do with their wastewater, that's the real jaw-dropper.
It's a greenhouse, but it's actually our wastewater treatment facility, which surprises
in half of a 30 by 100-foot greenhouse.
Well, let's walk back in the back here. Like I said, it's a divided greenhouse, and the back 70 feet of it is actually where the work is done.
They've recreated marshes, wetlands, and ponds.
We pump all our wastewater from our homes up here.
Everything from the toilets, everything that goes down the kitchen drain.
And it's processed through this facility, and we actually recycle it. This water is pumped back to the homes. It's reused as flush water.
Bill says this is basically a giant swimming pool filled with gravel.
So what you see here is our employees, 15 different varieties of wetland plants. So the plants are pulling the nutrients out of the waste stream, and also the bacteria that's symbiotic with the roots in the gravel are starting to do their magic as well.
The wastewater slowly works its way through the root zones of the plants. It's pumped from there to some open-top tanks with floating plants. And from there, it goes to a second artificial marsh and then into storage.
There is no chemicals. There's no mechanical processing. It's all natural. Basically, it's just bacteria.
They actually make a lot more clean water than they need. They use the rest of it to water the Christmas tree farm. The people here are walking the walk about living sustainably. For instance, an average American uses 75 gallons of water a day. Here, they use 15. And remember, 300 kilowatt hours of electricity a month instead of 1,600. And they're doing it in perfect comfort. It could be that Hunter Fall Farms is a step into all of our future.
And then I turn to my computer first thing to bring it on. It's a Dell computer, and I probably got this new, maybe 9 months ago from...
Where would we be these days without our computers? Some of us even love our computers, get insane about them. I won't even talk about my husband here. Instead, we want to check the environmental footprint of your love interest. Let's look at your computer. Or Letty's computer, if that'll make you feel less guilty. Because you will feel guilty after you hear this.
Owning a computer uses more energy over the life cycle than a refrigerator.
That's Eric Williams, an environmental engineering professor at Arizona State University. He just got a $236,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to examine the life cycle of your computer.
If you're looking at the total energy that you need to make a computer, it turns out to be around 4 times the energy that the computer uses when it's plugged into the wall. It's 260 kilograms of fossil fuels needed to make a 20-kilogram desktop computer.
So before the thing even hits your desk, it's already an energy hog. And as if that's not bad enough, once you're done wasting energy because you never remember to unplug your computer when you're not using it, right, after you're all done with the machine, it goes on to damage the earth in other ways.
I did ask whether the computer gets recycled because I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and when you get rid of a computer, there's a recycling
location that you can drop your computer off and the county recycles it.
Recycling. We hear the word and we just naturally assume green. But not necessarily, especially when it comes to computers. As Eric Williams says, most of our computers are recycled in the third world using very primitive processes.
The wires in a computer contain copper. Copper has a good price. So in order to get at that copper, pull out the wires, pile them up, set that on fire.
This is the Wilson Galleries in Lima, Peru. One of the places your recycled computer ends up.
Circuit boards contain copper. They contain gold. And in order to get at these are recycled using a process where you're using cyanide and acids. It's often done next to water sources, and so the water sources have been contaminated by the circuit board recycling and the other processes that are going on. These informal recycling impacts abroad seem to be really the most serious and pressing environmental issue associated with computers, and we need to have explicit engineering and explicit policy aimed to address these issues.
Eric Williams got his grant so that he could create recommendations for managing what's called the global reverse supply chain of computers. The forward supply chain is all the things that happen to get the computer to your desk.
Reverse supply chain here is all the things that happen after the computer leaves the first user.
Eric is traveling all over the world, trying to figure out what exactly happens to junk computers and junk cell phones and PDAs, all the small electronics that run our lives. It turns out that Letty isn't the only one who just assumes that it's a good thing, per se, to recycle computers. Most policymakers also default to doing what feels like it should be right.
We decide that recycling is good or landfilling is bad. And so we make a policy based on this sort of very generic concept, but we don't really ask the question, what benefit did we really get from this recycling?
Eric says other options are better.
On lot 40 here, nice little Dell. Let's go $25 on the computer, $25. $25 bid now, $25.
This is a computer auction where junk computers are resold to new users. Eric Williams' research suggests that once you're sure you're not going to be using your old computer anymore, sell it. Or give it away to someone who'll give it to disadvantaged kids. Eric's working on ideas to make that easier. One is to put radio frequency ID tags on every piece inside a computer. That way you could track it and prosecute people who are recycling it in ways that damage the environment.
The office has one radiator that is, from what I understand, set through a main computer, and the temperature is set. So,
sure, at the office, there's someone who decides how hot or cold it'll be. And there are some people who've installed thermostats at home that change the temperature depending on what time of day it is. But what if, based on what's best for the power grid or for the planet, the electric company could tell you to turn stuff down?
We're going to go out the front door.
In parts of California, they're already doing this.
To the west side of the house and look at the smart meter.
Liz Keough lives in Bakersfield. She's part of an experiment being run by Pacific Gas and Electric to test out what they call smart meters. At some point in the future, the smart meter will automatically do things like turning your washing machines from hot water to warm. Right now, though, it's all still fairly low-tech.
When they have a smart day, they will phone you and or email you.
PG&E will call a smart day when they think the power grid is going to be overtaxed. People in the smart meter program get rewarded for cutting back their energy use.
So the first thing is, we're not going to use the cooler or the air conditioner. What I am going to do is take my fan, I'm going to turn it on, and I'm going to turn it on kind of high.
The less power you use, the more money you make.
If you do dishes after lunch, then what you want to do is wait till maybe after dinner. And then turn the dishwasher on.
It all pays off for Liz at the end of the month when the bill shows up.
Then it says smart rate credits, $14.04. So I made out like a bandit.
She lives alone. If a family did this, they would save $35 or $40 a month.
Which these days isn't chump change for people.
At this point, I know you might be saying, yeah, yeah. One person turns off her lights. So what? How do we get everyone to turn off their lights?
If everybody does a little bit, it's easier than a few people doing a lot.
That's Marianne Piette, an energy scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. This question is constantly on her mind. What if we could find a way to take all the buildings in a big downtown, every supermarket and department store, and get them to turn off their lights or turn down their thermostats? Then we'd be getting somewhere.
I'm thinking can probably hear the fans, which is the main sound made by automation nowadays.
As of right now, Marianne thinks she's found the answer. This is the server facility of a company called Akuacom on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. Marianne's been working with Akuacom and the big California electric companies for the past few years. And what they now have is a working system. They send out signals to buildings all over the Bay Area. When the signals come in, the buildings automatically turn down their thermostats and their lights.
We programmed the control system to be able to receive a signal coming in over the internet that would change the cooling loads throughout the building.
When I get a signal from the utility that indicates that the utility would like to have a shed occur, it will appear on the program tab, and I can see the time that the event has come in. And
for their initial tests, they lined up some heavy hitters.
Walmart, Target, Cisco, Sybase, Oracle.
What you see on the screen here is a list of the large commercial buildings in California that are part of the current commercialized efforts for automated demand response.
We shed about a quarter of the total building electric load without getting complaints from people.
All those stores, all those office buildings turn down their electricity at the same time. That means fewer power plants are running, which means fewer greenhouse gas emissions. Right now, they use the system to cut power on hot days, but it could have other benefits. In California, there are times of day when more power is generated by windmills than by coal, and you could have more people use power then. However they use it, the thinking here is, I turn off my lights at my house, that's fine. But if Walmart turns off their lights, then we're getting somewhere. According to Joel McCower of GreenBiz.com, more and more businesses are getting on board. And not just when it comes to lights.
McDonald's eliminated the embossed golden arches on their napkins. But in doing that, they made their napkins 24% thinner, which meant that they could fit 24% more napkins in a box, more boxes in a truck. And they reduced the amount of transportation by the equivalent of about 100 tractor trailers a year, simply from that one simple act.
And they're not the only ones.
At Lafayette, at the Lafayette plant here, we make the Outback, the Legacy, the Tribeca, and just recently the Toyota Camry.
One of the ironies of the world of green business is that, contrary to what most people think, this is an area where companies are walking more than they're talking. They're doing more than they're saying.
We actually do recycle just about every, 99.8% of everything that we generate is recycled.
This is the Lafayette plant of Subaru of Indiana Automotive. In 2000, this plant was generating 459 pounds of waste for every car they produced. Denise Coogan is the plant's manager of environmental compliance.
Styrofoams and cardboards and pallets. Then we have our cafeteria waste, brown paper towels from the restroom. So our problem was we had all this waste that we were generating, and a lot of it was going to the landfill.
For environmental and cost-saving reasons, the company decided this couldn't go on. Their engineers went through a rigorous section-by-section look at every process inside the plant. And today...
Well, we send nothing to a landfill.
Admit it. You don't believe that's true, do you? According to Joel McCower of the website greenbiz.com, your reaction is not surprising.
We don't trust companies that say we're on the case. That's a big problem. And we have to figure out how to have a more honest and open conversation with companies. Companies specifically need to figure out how to be credible on these things in ways that they're not, even when they have amazing stories to tell.
Denise Coogan says that's certainly her experience.
And we've had people that's come in and just outright said, I don't believe you're actually doing this. And we show them how we're doing it. And then they always end up saying, wow, we just couldn't believe it could be done.
She says when you think about it, it's no great surprise that they're doing this.
I always like to say that waste is money. No matter how you cut it, waste is money.
Let's Let's take steel. Subaru was wasting tons of it. Then they turn the problem over to Mike Patterson, an engineer in the stamping section. Now, normally, they take a blank piece of steel, bolt it down, and pound out a part in press that works something like a cookie cutter. Mike found that the waste was coming from the steel that was outside the bolt.
We analyzed these parts one by one, determined the amount of material that was outside of that line, and then tried to estimate how much we thought we could reduce that number.
It was a painstaking process, cutting and recutting the blank sheets, then stamping and restamping them to figure out exactly how small they could be and still fit under the bolt.
We actually hand-sheared several hundred blanks and ran them in succession and then checked the parts to make sure that they were good before we went with that change.
They had to do this with 67 different car parts. It took 6 months. They went through a similar process with styrofoam. Pretty much every major part that goes into a Subaru in Indiana is shipped in styrofoam from Japan. Instead of continuing to throw it all in the trash, they asked engineer Greg Tyson to figure out an alternative. One of the things Greg did was walk around the shop and examine the condition of every piece of styrofoam lying around on the floor.
I felt that the material they were sending us was still in good enough shape to use back in Japan.
Greg did an extensive analysis of precisely how everyone in the plant does their job, and then redesigned the workspaces to find room for a bin to stack styrofoam in. Now,
they take the camshaft out of the form, they place it into the engine, assemble their engine, and then when they're done with the form, they actually discard it into a container and stack it basically exactly the way they would receive it.
Those containers are gathered, put on trucks, and sent back to Japan, where new parts are put in them, and they're sent back to the U.S. Some of the styrofoam forms have been back and forth across the Pacific 7 times, and none of them are ending up in the landfill. What they've done at Subaru is impressive. But Joel McCower of GreenBiz.com says,
one of the things I'm asked a lot is this a trend? Is this a fad? Is this a bubble? Is it going to go away at some point? And the answer is no.
See how that works out for him, and I'll give you a call back. Okay.
We're great. Back with our friend Letty in her office.
Bye-bye. Excuse me, but I'm going to have to go visit the ladies' room.
We humans tread pretty heavily on this earth, mostly because there's so many of us. Someone goes to the bathroom. And someone else does. And another. And another. Over time, it adds up.
The increase of dead zones in the ocean really corresponds to the increasing use of nitrogen and fertilizers, and also the increase of human population, particularly in coastal areas.
That's Fran Dunwell, Hudson River Estuary Coordinator for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. She's talking about a phenomenon that's becoming more and more serious around the world, something called hypoxic dead zones.
A hypoxic dead zone is an area where you have low oxygen to the point that living creatures can't survive.
They're caused primarily by nitrogen that gets in the water from fertilizer and from human waste. They kill everything along the bottom of a water body. And they're growing. According to an August 2008 article in Science magazine, dead zones have now been reported for more than 400 rivers, lakes, and oceans, and they affect a total area of more than 152,000 square miles. But the Science article had a piece of good news. There are a small handful of places where the dead zones have vanished. One of them is in one of the last places you'd ever imagine.
We are northbound on the East River, and we are about to cross under the Manhattan Bridge.
Rob Buchanan runs the community boathouse on Pier 40 on Hudson River Park in Manhattan.
So I'm looking at the skyline of Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And
he's canoeing on a body of water that has one of the worst reputations in America.
A lot of what we do is address stereotypes, frankly. Go and say to people who say, I wouldn't get in that water if you paid me $1 million, and say, well, look, we won't pay you, but come out with us someday and see if you don't like it.
It turns out that the East River is one of the world's success stories. Of the 400 bodies of water that researchers looked at in the Science Magazine article, 3 had seen their dead zones disappear. New York's East River was one of them.
Hey, Nockham, can you take a couple strokes up there? Just to bring us head down, and then we can all fall in together.
The way they cleaned it up holds lessons for us and for the rest of the world's water. We'll tell you about it when we come back. Plus, we'll take a look at concrete that sucks CO2 right out of the air. This is Sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave, and we'll be back after a break. This is Sustainability, part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Longer, but let's just row up into this flat and then we'll take a break, okay?
We're canoeing on the East River between Manhattan and Brooklyn. And yes, we have heard all the old jokes, like, he fell for her like his heart was a mob informant and she was the East River. Yuck, yuck, yuck. It's true, though. The East River's lousy reputation is earned.
Floating down the river, floating down the river, in the evening by the bright moonlight.
About the time this song was written, New York's Metropolitan Sewage Commission made its first report about the condition of the city's waterways. Fran Dunwell is with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation.
You had 10 feet of sludge in the river bottom. You had gas bubbles the size of a football bubbling up on a regular basis.
New Yorkers were dying of typhoid and getting sick from eating oysters.
It was really a horrible situation.
It would be another 30 years before the city finally built its first sewage treatment plants. And while they took care of the typhoid, they didn't address the dead zones. By the 1980s, the situation was bleak. Giant algae blooms were spreading, choking off oxygen and killing nearly all the finfish and shellfish. Something had to be done.
Okay, we're currently standing outside aeration tank number 4, which is currently being upgraded for a full...
The city turned to Keith Mahoney, an engineer with the Department of Environmental Protection. Remember the TV show The Odd Couple and that episode where they meet a guy who knows absolutely everything about New York parking?
7th Avenue, Broadway, no parking between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. 75th Street, you got your school zone, no parking. You got your church on the corner.
Well, Keith liked that about New York sewers. He's the kind of guy who'll say something like this.
We were able to nitrify the centrate stream outside of the typical step feed B&R process. That also...
And when he says stuff like that, you just nod. Because, you know, even if you don't, he knows what he's talking about.
Right now, we're in North Queens at the Tolman Island Treatment Plant. It has a dry weather capacity of 80 MGD and a wet weather capacity of 160 MGD.
Tolman Island is where the city developed, tested, and implemented their plan to fight the dead zones.
Which we trace back to being excess nitrogen in the water system.
Algae feeds off nitrogen. When they looked at where the nitrogen was coming from, it was like that old Pogo cartoon. We have met the enemy, and he is us.
When they looked at the cause, it seemed to be those excess nitrogen from just treatment plants and all.
Up to this point, they'd been doing wastewater treatment the same way in New York City for decades. By the way, if you're eating right now, please forgive me. Or you might want to just stop. The old process was basically like sifting sand. They'd use screens to take out the chunky pieces. Then they'd blow some air into it to break it up, disinfect it, and dump it into the East River. Keith and his team had been experimenting with a new idea, an unconventional kind of nitrogen removal system. Because they're engineers, they had to give it, of course, an incomprehensible name. In this case, Step Feed BNR.
So we wanted to advance the step feed biological nutrient removal as quickly as possible and see if it really worked.
So in 1990, they retrofitted one of the tanks here at Tolman Island to test their new process and see if they could get rid of the nitrogen. The results were impressive.
We removed 50% of the nitrogen in the wastewater, which is minor retrofits.
But they didn't stop there. In addition to loving nitrogen, algae demands lots and lots of oxygen. Keith and his team struck on a novel idea. Make the algae bloom before it hits the river.
We're actually growing it in the aeration tanks under controlled conditions where we supply the oxygen.
What Keith figured out was you have to satisfy the algae, give it all the oxygen at once, before it goes into the river.
Right now we're standing right outside of the process air blower building. This is the facility that supplies all the air to the aeration tanks needed for the biological oxygen demand process.
They have these massive air blowers that pump oxygen into the algae while it's still inside the tank. They take the algae all the way through its life cycle right there in the tank. It blooms, and then it dies.
So basically we're taking a natural process that occurs in the receiving waters, doing a much more concentrated, controlled footprint, and eliminating all the oxygen demand right up front.
Then they send it off for what's called digestion, where they cook it for 15 days. That burns off a lot of the solid waste that's still in it and kills any pathogens. It also produces methane gas that could be used to operate engines and boilers. And it turns out there's another place, besides the bottom of the East River, where they could put it.
First, the very bottom part of the geyser fire.
Inside a drab, institutional yellow, concrete block building, Purdue University mechanical engineering professor Fu Zhao is walking around the guts of what will soon become his new gasifier. That's a machine that makes ethanol. Making ethanol is no big deal these days, but Dr. Zhao's machine is. His partner on the project, Dr. Suresh Rao, is a Purdue environmental engineer. He explains that making ethanol,
it's based on converting corn grain, which is obviously a competing resource, as a food. So we're looking at a non-competitive system which does not involve food, as opposed to actually using waste biomass to convert to transportation fuel.
And they've done it. This machine they're building will take common everyday garbage
from agriculture, from forestry, or even municipal solid waste,
feed it into the gasifier, and turn it into fuel.
The gas can be resynthesized into liquid fuel, so beyond ethanol, you can produce diesel as an example. In addition, of course, you can also have the option of producing electricity as a byproduct as well.
To put this in its most basic form, we're talking here about making gas out of garbage. It sounds like science fiction, but Dr. Rao says it's not.
There is, in fact, a contract in northern Indiana to convert garbage to ethanol through thermal gasification process. So maybe the reality of full commercialization is not too far away.
So as the two catalysts, we have a cell and it has two cylinders, and then the two cylinders are connected by a glass frit. Right.
Another way to address our environmental problems is to curb global warming by finding a way to use more electricity that doesn't come from coal-fired power plants, like maybe electricity from the sun. For years, we have been this close to doing that. And when I say this close, I'm holding my fingers this far apart. Anyway, we've been this close using photovoltaic cells that turn solar power into electricity. But the problem with solar cells is, what do you do at night? And what do you do when it's raining?
And then we fill it with water. And then in one side of the cell, we have a platinum electrode.
We're in the lab of someone who may have figured that out. Dan Nocera, a chemistry professor at MIT. There's something that every tree and every piece of grass can do that machines can't do. As Dan Nocera explains, plants convert sunlight to electricity, just like a photovoltaic does. But
when the sun goes down, what do? And it turns out they store solar light, and then they convert that sunlight into a fuel, which they can store inside the plant and keep on living when the sun goes down.
In cracking that process, Dan Nocera thinks he's found a way to make solar cells that work 24/7. Here's how it goes.
Our friend, photosynthesis. The tree makes electricity in its leaves.
Oh, do I have to do the rest of the show like this? No, good. Thank you. The electricity is fed to two catalysts.
One catalyst takes water to oxygen.
Then, in another part of the leaf, the tree makes hydrogen at another catalyst.
So we've tried to do the same thing.
Scientists have known this process for 100 years.
The issue is, can you do those things that we already know how to do with new materials and new ways to do it so it's really cheap?
Right now, they use platinum as the oxygen catalyst. So much for cheap. But Dan Nocera's beaten that, too.
It's the oxygen catalyst that's special here, and we made a very simple compound that forms when you put electricity on an electrode.
He's doing it with cobalt and phosphate.
So now what I'm doing is I'm turning on some current, so I'm putting a positive charge on the glass, and as I do it, you start to see this black, thin film forming on the electrode.
The special catalyst splits the water.
It splits water to hydrogen and oxygen, which we can store downstairs. And then at night, you take the hydrogen and oxygen and recombine them over a fuel cell. Then you get the electricity back.
The process can't be mass-produced yet, but he's working with engineers from battery companies, gas compression companies, and photovoltaic companies. And he says it won't be long before this is on the market and generating electricity from the sun, day or night, rain or shine. There are some obvious, big-time emitters of greenhouse gas that you can probably name right off the top of your head. But here's one you probably didn't know of. It's estimated that concrete accounts for close to 5% of the world's CO2 emissions. Michael Prather from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change explains why.
Concrete manufacture basically involves taking calcium carbonate rock and driving the CO2 off it.
In the cement manufacturing process, about a ton of carbon dioxide gets put off into the atmosphere for every ton of cement that's made. But now engineers are looking at ways to change that. Liev Hasselbach is an environmental engineering professor at Washington State University. She's an expert on concrete. You can tell she is because she likes telling jokes like this.
Concrete isn't really concrete in that sense. It's a funny thing to say.
Well, no, it's not, but that's okay. Anyways, Liev was given about $35,000 by the National Science Foundation to find ways of making the concrete manufacturing process more carbon neutral. She seized on an idea that's basic to the chemistry of concrete.
Concrete itself can reabsorb the CO2 fairly rapidly.
And not only can it absorb it, but when carbon dioxide gets inside concrete,
it actually turns back into limestone.
Liev Hasselbach's grant, among other things, is designed to look into ways of using that natural process to reduce global warming.
There is potential for us to build sidewalks where, yes, these sidewalks will suck CO2 out of the air.
That is exciting. And whoever thought they'd hear the words concrete and exciting in the same sentence? But that's only part of it.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to head out and hop in the Land Rover.
Brent Constance is one of those people you read about in business magazines. He makes things that make life better and that make him very, very rich. Brent invented a type of concrete for orthopedic surgeons. Doctors loved it. Brent cashed in and sold the company. Then he got involved with the Woods Institute of the Environment at Stanford, where he came to the conclusion that
the only way to address climate change is to do carbon capture and sequestration.
That means grabbing CO2 out of the air and putting it someplace where it can't do any harm. Brent started a new company called Calera that does just that. They've invented a process whose impact is stunning, potentially a total game changer when it comes to global warming. Basically, what they do is set up a cement plant next to an emitter of CO2.
The main ones are power plants, principally coal-fired power plants, oil plants, etc.
They grab the CO2 out of the plant before it gets into the atmosphere, and then
our green cement actually takes the carbon dioxide from the emissions from the power plant and converts that carbon dioxide into carbonate mineral. Maybe a simpler way to say it is it turns the carbon dioxide into a solid by converting the carbon dioxide to carbonate, and that's essentially limestone.
The carbon dioxide never reaches the atmosphere. They turn it back into rock before it ever hits the air. Right now, Calera has one plant, which they set up next to a major greenhouse gas polluter.
The power plant here at Moss Landing produces 3.4 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. And that's equivalent to about 700,000 cars.
The work Liev Hasselbach is doing would take the concrete industry and move it from being a greenhouse gas polluter to being basically neutral. The Calera process takes it that one step further.
This gives the material itself a negative carbon footprint. So it's not just less bad, it's actually taking us into the negative zone.
America used 2.3 billion tons of cement in 2007. China made 1.4 billion tons. Remember, a ton of carbon dioxide gets put into the air for every ton of cement. If the Calera process was in wide use, that's 4 billion tons of CO2 that would never reach the air. Think what that could do for global warming. So, that's a look at some of the tools, the green tools that we have on hand to help us tackle some of the world's worst environmental problems. They're right there for us to use. The question is, will we take up the challenge? Will we make the sacrifices to do it? Purdue's Larry Nye says, we don't have a choice.
I don't have a lot of patience for people that the first words out of their mouth is that it'll be difficult, or we can't do that, or I'm not willing to do that.
I think we've come to a proverbial fork in the road.
Joel McCower of GreenBiz.com.
On one hand, we can go down this business-as-usual road with the potential that we have cataclysmic problems that are simply unimaginable. And the other road is the potential of having clean, renewable energy, of having zero-waste factories. There's a lot that technology can do, but it's not technology's problem to solve. It's people's problem to solve, which means that we have to be ready to make the changes both as individuals and as a society. And unless we're willing to do that, all the clean technology in the world isn't going to be able to save us.
Sustainability was written and produced by Richard Paul. It was edited by Richard Miles. Our remote engineers were P.W. Fenton, Walter Dixon, Rebecca McEnroy, Ben Taylor, Mark Howell, Krista Almanzan, Sarus Farivar, Jennifer Ball, Julie Kane, Carrie Swanson, and Greg Bray. Special thanks to Betty Carson Mockridge at Purdue Radio, WBAA. Our music was composed and arranged by Lenny Williams. This program is part of the Global Challenges series from the Purdue University College of Engineering. On the web at purdue.edu. I'm Barbara Bogave.